This is Alan Piggott, interviewed by Chris Alden Lee on the 11th of June 2012. Alan Piggott, Part 2.
Were you at Argentine Island continuously for 3 years, or did you come back from season to season?
No, continuous. I was on the Bisco in September 1958. I arrived back home in June 1962.
You may not realise
almost 4 years.
Yeah, you may not realise this, but it's very unusual for anybody to do 3 years in...
Yes, you know it is. I read an article in the Bass magazine, which named someone as being the longest consecutive member. And I thought, that's not quite true. Because I was there a bit longer than he was. One of those things. It was while I was in the second year that I was enjoying it, and what was the name of the secretary in Stanley? Green.
Johnny Green.
Johnny Green. I consulted the base leader first and said, look, I'd like to see a third year. And he agreed, and he sent a signal off to John. And the answer came back, yeah, OK, if you want to, you can do a third year. That was it.
What were you enjoying?
I think it wasn't just one thing. I think it was everything. I was enjoying not necessarily the cold weather, but certainly the summer weather. I was enjoying the, if you like, the camaraderie of the people that I was based with. I was enjoying the routine. I'd come to grips with the job that I had to do and was getting good at it. And it was, even the other things, like, as I mentioned earlier, the days that it was my job to empty the toilet, you know. I didn't mind that at all because there were lots of things that go with it. And I was learning other things as well, I suppose. In a sense, Chris, I think I was still growing up. I learned a few chords on the guitar. I learned more about music, jazz, folk, classical. Not a lot, but enough for me. I learned a lot about Antarctic history. I read the books that were there in the library. I think in towards the end, I was probably a bit more outgoing than I was when I first started there in January. Well, by the time I arrived in... at the beginning of the first year. So there were all these things. And then on a one-to-one basis, you people like... If you could get people talking about themselves, that was interesting. Where have you been? Where are you going? A lot of these lads, after their stint down there, would very often go abroad. Harry Agger, for example, one of the two physicists, ended up living in California, as far as I know. Still a good friend of Barry Shaw's, and we keep saying to one another, you know, we'll meet sometimes, but that's been going on for about 4 years now and never happened. Chris taught me to play chess. You know, these were great things for a young man. And I enjoyed them so much so, I suppose, there was some motivation there for me to stay there and continue.
Had you lost interest in the outside world? Did you keep abreast of world affairs?
I think we did. I think we were introspective to the Argentine Islands and the people that we were. There wasn't a lot of chance of finding out what was going on in the outside world, because certainly through the winter months, radio reception was very poor anyway. There was a programme that was deliberately intended for the bases down there that was broadcast, in which we were given personal appearances, if you like, of some relatives, and all the lads down there took it in turn to receive something from their mother, father, brother, sister. It was only a 2 minutes worth. It was like just a greeting to say everything's okay, hope you're okay, and all the rest of it. And I recorded. I had an old, well, it wasn't old. It was brand new. It was a Grundig tape recorder with a big spools on it. And I recorded.
You're taking that with you,
are
you?
No, I bought it when I was down there.
In Stanley.
Yeah, and so I thought it'd be a good idea to record these programmes as we receive them. Not with the equipment that you see today, but it was simply out of the speaker on top of the receiver to the microphone attached to the tape recorder. And I recorded quite a lot of them and eventually sent them back to the BBC so that they could get some idea of how we were receiving them on these bases in Grahamland. And I think they were very grateful. Eventually, I don't think they made that much of it. I suppose their technology in 1962-ish was as advanced as it could be at that time, but certainly nothing like it is today. And they simply returned the tapes to me with a thank you letter, and that was the end of the matter.
Did you receive a message?
Yeah, I got one. I think I got two, one in 61 and one in 62. And again, it was my mother and one of my sisters just to say, hello, Alan. Hope you're okay, love. Looking forward to you coming home. But all you can do is listen. You can't respond to it, of course. But it was nice to hear the voices. My dad never, he wouldn't. He was almost housebound anyway. But it was quite pleasant. And I used to arrange it. So in the early days, everybody on the base would come into the shack just to listen to the programme and listen to the messages. And we were all very, very quiet whilst the messages were coming through. Eventually, I managed to wire a speaker from the receiver two or three doors down into the sitting room so that they could listen to them there. There was no loss of quality between the WOT shack and the living room, so the lads could sit comfortably. But it's one of those things, there's no privacy anywhere. So if I'm receiving a message, could be 10 lads stood behind me listening to the same message.
So it was never embarrassing, though?
Oh, no, never embarrassing.
Some of the kids found it quite embarrassing at times.
Really?
Yeah.
No, well, certainly it wasn't for me. I just thought it was nice to hear my mother's voice.
Interestingly, I mean, in this modern day and age where you can pick up a phone and ring home, that programme still exists.
Does it?
Once a year on Midwinter's Day.
Right.
And the winters all gather around the radio receiver at Halley and rather than listen to it.
Mind you, I would expect that the quality of reception and transmission at Halley Bay, because of the modern equipment, is much better than it was. Really.
It depends upon the atmospherics, really.
Yeah, of course it does.
But you didn't hear the World Service at all or pick up news from other sources? You weren't aware of the growing tensions in around Cuba, or
I suppose I must have been, but I don't remember.
Announced the space race.
I don't remember much about it. I one of the things that I was keen to do was amateur radio. I got a license as a radio ham from Stanley, and I would wait until probably 10, 11 o'clock at night, even in winter, And it was surprising what you can pick up. I was picking ham operators up in Canada and Eastern Europe and Australia. It was wonderful to talk to them. In fact, we had a regular schedule, actually, along with Halle Bay and a chap who lived in Timaru in New Zealand. And I can't remember his name, unfortunately. But, you know, they certainly, I would listen to Halle Bay and Timaru because my equipment and my transmission had a lot further to go than the Halle Bay one had to New Zealand. But occasionally I talked to this gentleman, and but very often the signal just went down and down and down during the transmission.
Voice or Morse?
Voice, right. as far as we could, because I don't think the gent in Timaru had Morse experience. He had some wonderful equipment, and just listening to him was clear as a bell until atmospherics took over, you know.
Were you able to reach the UK?
On one odd occasion I did, and it was someone in West Yorkshire, but I don't remember the details.
But you weren't in regular communication with him anymore?
No, I wasn't. There was a chap who lived, an American, lived up by the Great Lakes, Minnesota. And I suppose, maybe because of the way the aerial was turned, I was able to talk to him a little bit more than I was with others. And I remember one occasion when we had on base a little, what's called a 68 set, which was carried around in a haversack. It's only this big, you know, what, 18 inches high, 12 inches wide. And there was a great big stuffy battery in the bottom. And I attached a key to that and started plugging away to look for any response. And believe it or not, this little 68 set was bringing responses from America, left, right and centre. It was glorious. I could sit there all night just receiving these stations. The reason for this is because our call signs in the Antarctic began with the letters VP. I was VP8EE. And a lot of radio hams around the world spend a lot of time trying to collect different call signs. And ours was a fairly rare one. So having started it, I could end up with a queue of North American radio hams wanting to make contact just to say, you know, have you received my signal? Yeah, and then we'd send them a printed card saying, yeah, you've been in touch with VP8EE. Wonderful stuff. And the other thing that I used to listen to quite a lot was there was a programme that came out of Argentina. A superb guitarist called Eduardo Falou. And whenever I could, I used to tune into his programme and just listen to him playing the guitar. Fantastic stuff. Absolutely wonderful.
And the reception was good enough to listen to some of those guitars?
Some of it was. The conditions for radio reception were different as between summer and winter. Mm. Winter, everything went down the toilet, you know. But in summer, things could be better. Even so, it could be difficult according to distance. But we got quite a lot. Not too much voice, because with these receivers that we had, I think there was probably a lot of interference with coded Morse signals coming across, and what we used to call carrier waves. You know, you'd be listening to something and suddenly this great big whistling came up that destroyed the signal that you were listening to, and that was the end of it as far as you were concerned.
Rather unusually, you're the first person to mention this in my experience of doing these interviews. You were obliged to sit there and take down the entire Antarctic Treaty by Morse code.
Yes. Yeah.
Tell me about that experience.
Was this 1959 or 1960? I'm not sure which year it was. It was fairly early on, I think. What I did, we were warned, all the radio operators were warned, that Stanley were going to send us a copy of the recently signed Antarctic Treaty. We were also warned that it was a pretty long document. And so what I did, because I was the only base to send the results of the radio sonde, upper atmosphere observations, I arranged with Stanley that they might send me the Antarctic Treaty immediately after I'd sent that observation, and I would record it on my tape recorder. And I recorded it. I asked them to send it fast. I recorded it at high speed on my tape recorder, and then at my leisure I could alter the speed of the tape so I could listen to it at the speed that I could understand, and then take it down from there, which I did over quite a few days actually. because it was, like most things like this, it's couched in civil service type language. But the gist of it was interesting. I quite proudly took it, after I'd written it out, took it to the base leader and said, look, it's the Antarctic Treaty. And a great big wad of signal pads. It was great, that.
Did anybody read it?
Well, I read it, that's for sure, and I think the base leader did, but apart from that, I don't think anybody was really interested.
Were there other messages that you took? Crises, medical situations, personal problems that you can talk about? Disasters? Presumably you had to send a signal back saying the beaver had sunk, didn't you?
Oh, well, yeah, but that would be done by the base leader in code,
right, for
Stanley, and I wouldn't even know, you know, what this code was about. It was just a report, really, that the beaver had gone. That was the end of it.
What about other significant issues?
I'm not sure I remember very many, if any, to be honest. There might have been the odd occasion, and I must admit, I'm only guessing, when some member of one of our lads' family had perhaps passed away or was ill or something like that. But I think that's as serious as it got. The one thing that we did listen to, I think I've got to get this right, that there was someone with toothache at one of the more northern bases, and we had a doctor. and our doctor had to supervise the yanking out of this tooth, because that was the only remedy.
What, by Morse code?
No, we managed to. There's an evening programme. When the ships come down, which is in summer, of course, and reception is much better. At 9 o'clock, I think it was, 8 o'clock perhaps, in the evening, all the bases would set up on 3.8 or whatever, this particular frequency. And we had what's called the Goon Show. Now, this meant that the ship, whether it was the Biscoe, the Shackleton, one of the American ones or the Kistadan or whatever, we'd all tune in, and someone would start it off. Where are you? When will you be arriving at base F? And we'd get a response from the ship, and then that meant that after that, some of the other bases could chip in asking similar questions, or the bases could talk between themselves. So it was quite handy, actually. There was something. One of the things we did at Base F was we decided we were going to put a play together, which we did. From memory, it was called The Dear Departed. And I remember Barry and Harry, Jeff and myself, all having parts in this play.
You write it yourselves?
Oh, no, it was... Yeah, it was something taken from a...
book.
From a book somewhere. And I think we made a reasonable fist of it, but, of course, we were all stupid amateurs. But having said that, we really enjoyed it. And we recorded it. And then we put it out on the Goon Show. But, you know, people said, oh, yeah. Well, it was something to listen to, if nothing else. It was great. That's the kind of thing that we did. Silly.
But you never had to send messages of disaster or tragedy or...
Not that I recall.
Serious illness.
No, yeah. The most serious one was the beaver going in.
Yeah.
I may have forgotten something, Chris, but no, I don't actually remember at the moment.
What about visiting parties? Did the Chileans or the Argentinians ever come and see?
We never had any foreign visitors, to the best of my knowledge, but we did once have a visit from by helicopter from HMS Protector. Clive made some of his booby trap buns. These were donuts filled with jam.
Five Pearson.
Yeah. Now, when you stuck your teeth into one of these, the jam came out all over the naval uniform. And, you know, they saw it as good fun. It was only, I think, there might be one or two of these occasions. I think on one occasion, the governor actually came down as well with them, just to, you know, have a look around the base and off again. They don't last very long, though, these things, an hour or so, and that's it.
Americans? North wind, west wind?
North wind, west wind, south wind, east wind. They had them all, didn't they? We had one of them. Could have been north wind. They're a funny lot of the Americans. They don't seem to realise that they don't recognise danger. The north wind would moor somewhere, you know, at a safe distance from the island. Lower a boat. Row it in, motor it in. And I would remember this fellow in the back of the boat. The beach, well, we know beach, it was just rocks rising out of the water, to sloping up to a height of 10 to 12 feet. This sailor throws the rope at one of us from his boat, and says, oh, tie that on somewhere, will you, friend? Well, there was nowhere to tie it to because it's all solid rock and he couldn't see it. So we just held on to his rope and brought him ashore. But, there's quite a difference, actually, between the discipline in American Navy and that in British Navy. It's funny, really.
What was it like having Americans on the base? Did they stay for... Did they get the jam donut treatment?
No, they didn't, but... one of the things that they always did was the Americans are good at gadgets. They're a gadget for everything. And they're also good at showing off. So you got a bit sick of them after a while. There was one American... he actually sailed down with us. He was coming as an observer just for a look round. And he invited one of our members to play chess. And he mated in, I don't know, three or four moves. It was incredible. But at that time, I didn't understand what chess was all about. So he was another one who kept, "Have you seen this? Have you seen him bring out some sort of gadget? This is for the cold weather in the Antarctic. It keeps your hands warm or something." And now we're just wearing gloves and mittens. Fantastic. I'm not all that keen on Americans, to be honest, Chris.
We'll move on, shall we? the hat was extended at some time during your...
Yes, it was. I volunteered to help Jim Shercliffe to build it.
Did he come down specifically to do that?
Yes, I think he did.
Right. It was his forte, wasn't it?
Yeah. Oh, yes. He was a great man. Super, very solid, very knowledgeable, down to earth, and a damn good builder at that. And Jim spent a lot of time towards the end of winter putting the pilings in. I mean, temperatures, even for base F, were pretty extreme. But got them done, and then... most of the hut, of course, was sectionalised. And I helped him the best I could. We got the shell up. And then we were doing all the woodwork, the timber work inside. And it was really just an extension of the corridor down the centre of the hut with rooms off either side. Because we had some special equipment coming down. I don't know what it was, but I knew that the chap who was supposed to run it was called Jeff Thompson, and he was a lazy so-and-so. He was in bed nearly all day long. Anyway, Jim and I, and maybe from time to time helped by others, we got the shell up, and then we started building the inside. And the cladding on the walls was... it was like a thinnish type of asbestos, but it wasn't asbestos. It was very thin, like, just to go on the outside, and then you paint it. Well, there were hundreds of these sheets of 8x4, whatever it was, which we stacked up against the one part of the woodwork inside the hut. And at the point where Jim wanted to start putting these sheets to the walls, to the framework, he asked me to go get one, the first one. And I duly went to the pile as it stood up and had trouble in separating it from the rest. Struggled with it, and eventually it ended up, the whole pile, the thickness about this, so there must have been 40 or 50 sheets of this stuff, fell over. And I tried to hold them back and shouted for Jim. And Jim came, but the two of us couldn't hold it. And eventually it collapsed on top of both of us. Our legs were trapped. After shouting for help for several minutes, we got the help that we needed, and someone lifted them off. And I was okay, a little bit of sprain, but nothing. Jim's leg was broken. Fortunately, we got a doctor on base, and he ended up in plaster, and the work on the extension stopped for quite some time because he just couldn't do it. But I always blame myself for that. Because, mind you, the things weren't stacked right in the first place. They were stacked near vertical, so that if you touched any of them, it would be easy for them to fall over.
Tell me a bit more about Jim. What sort of worker was he?
Hard. He knew his stuff, and he was there every minute of daylight, And bearing in mind that the evenings could be quite long, he would still be there. He rarely took any time off.
Wasn't much time for recreation.
Yeah, on and off for most of us. Whatever jobs we had to do, we did, even though the work might be in the evening. But whenever you weren't doing that and you weren't on any other duties like cooking or cleaning or anything like that, yeah, you enjoyed yourself in recreation, like I mentioned.
So you got you went out skiing, you did some boating.
Yeah.
Did you become a proficient skier?
I was a lousy skier.
Did it matter?
I was frightened of it, actually. But some of the others, Harry, for instance, he became, he was really good at it. He got a better sense of balance than I had. See, one of my problems was that when I arrived there, I was, a 9-stone weakling. I was very thin. And over time, because of Clive's and Tony's and whoever's cooking, I gradually put on some weight. And eventually, I got a nickname myself. I was called El Gordo, the fat one, because I really did put it on. And I think that sort of didn't help with the skiing practice.
But you managed to get away occasionally. There's a trip to Peterson Island.
Yeah, Peterman.
Peterman,
that was there was a hut on Peterman Island owned by the Argentinians. Disused for long periods. And three of us, Walter, Fraser and myself, decided with basically his permission to go on holiday. We were only talking about one night. And we manhandled the sledge, the 5-6 miles up to Peterman Island, opened the hut and spent the night there. And Peterman Island itself is a sort of a domed island. And I think Fraser and Walter decided the following day, before we set on back, that they were going to climb it. Now, I don't have a head for height, so I stayed at low level whilst they did the climb. After that, we just hauled it all the way back again. But it was nice to have a break. Some of the lads, Martin, I think Bob was one of them, there might have been one or two more, decided that they would like to get across the sea ice to Cape Tuxen, which was part of the mainland of Graham Land. And that really was a hike across the sea ice in winter and then climb up the cape itself, which they did. But it took a day or two to do it. Very intrepid, that's where the word comes.
All this, of course, in a pretty stunning and spectacular landscape.
Oh, yes. The peace of it was profound. It really was. I could put my skis on and climb up to the top of the hill at the back of the hut, which would probably take me up about 100 feet above sea level. And from there you could see the landscape of quite a long piece of Graham Land itself, the mountains. To stand there on a summer's evening and first of all see the scenery as it gets bathed in sunlight, as the sun's going down and it starts to turn crimson. But more than that, you suddenly realise there's not a sound in the air, and it's absolutely wonderful. I mean, you could say deafening, but it wasn't. It was so quiet. It was absolutely unbelievable. With the sea mirrored, absolutely calm, beautiful. Then at the beginning of summer, when the ice is beginning to break up, you start to see the penguins coming back. And that is a sight to see as well, because they're in lines all the way going south past the island. You know, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds in this line, and then hundreds more in that line, and then hundreds more crossing them. And if you look from the top of the island, got this big open, big sea ice between us and the mainland, and you watch the little black lines going past. You wonder, first of all, what they were until you realise that that's it. But it's fantastic. And as the ice breaks up, so the seals start to come onto the floes. And you can get a decent sized floe about the size of this bungalow with 30 or 40 seals on it, just laying there in the sunshine. What a great sight. Wonderful.
Did you ever have any philosophical or spiritual or religious contemplations whilst you were down there?
Yeah. I wonder why they call them philosophical. When I was 16, 17, yeah, before I went into the RAF, I had a girlfriend who was the daughter of the curate of our local church. He was a superb man, a really honest man. And eventually, I went to confirmation classes. This was 17, 18 years old. And I think that was the beginning of my serious thinking about religion. Now, the relationship with the girl stopped. But my conviction carried on. And I think in those moments when I was outside the hut looking round, I think I felt something of the power of it all, you know. And I suppose I've always argued since then, you know, that I am a firm believer. I do believe in God. But how did we all come about? You know, this is the big argument these days, isn't it? What caused the Big Bang? My answer is simple, because I'm a simple person anyway. But I certainly wouldn't argue with the scientists. And I think it was during those moments and those hours that I would be wandering around the outside of the hut that my religious thoughts gained strength in some ways. Politics, no, I never even considered that. Philosophy. There was a book. Oh, my goodness. Bob Thomas, one of the Met people. Oh, I can't. Russell. The famous philosopher.
Bertrand Russell.
That's the one, Bertrand Russell. Written a book. Oh, what a great big thing it was. And Bob Thomas, I would like to have read it. It picked it up from our library anyway, but I said to Bob one day, I'd like to read that when you finish with it, please. Well, it took him nearly 12 months, and I never got around to reading it, but I would love to have done.
It's not too late.
No, still find it. I might even look for it on my Kindle. You never know.
So just, can you expand a little bit then? Would you feel the presence of a creator in
yes.
the Antarctic?
Yeah. I'll give you one example.
Please.
Let's see. 1974. We moved to Doncaster. I was appointed as the registrar the what was then the Doncaster College of Technology. During that first year of being in Doncaster, I contracted gastric flu. I was off work. We were staying in a maisonette because we hadn't yet bought our own house. And I was running upstairs to the loo almost every 10, 15 minutes. It was a terrible experience. Now, whether you believe this or not, after doing this for several days, a voice said, "Go in peace." I'm a little bit embarrassed to say that, because I've never shared it with anybody. But from that moment on, I was okay. It was incredible. And, you know, for me, that was a miracle. Simple.
And had anything of that nature at all happened whilst you're in the Antarctic? Had you sensed the creator around you in the landscape or the beauty?
Well, I'd thought about it a lot. Because of the beauty of the place, but not only that, but the incredible cruelty of the place as well, having read some of the books. And you think, you know, something behind this. I remember, I think we were on the Shackleton. I'd finally finished my 3 years, and we were going a bit further south before we were due to go back to Stanley. We were parked off somewhere north of Stonington. Several of us were sat in the ward or sitting room, whatever it's called on the Shackleton. And suddenly we heard this enormous bang. And in fact, it was the keel of the ship that had touched bottom. So no damage was done to the ship, but of course it panicked us a bit. We were all on deck in an instant. And at that moment, the wind blew up. And this was a wind. Great job. There were ice floes. The captain had got the ship moving, taking it to safer water. But there were ice floes going past the ship. It was moving that fast, was the current. I thought to myself, this is it. This is the end. No, it isn't. God's here. But the incredible force of this movement of ice really got to me. And there was another incident as well. It was during winter. A storm blew off. And this really was a storm. It was the worst we'd ever suffered for what was known locally as the Banana Belt. And the Met lads said, the wind is really strong, you ought to come and see this. Well, we got clobbered up and I stood at the bottom end of the hut. And it was really difficult to even open your eyes because the wind was coming straight into your face. But I remember Martin said, look over there, Alan. Now, about a quarter of a mile away, there was another island, which was, again, domed. And its height above sea level must have been 50 or 60 feet, and the waves were breaking over it. What a sight that was. But unfortunately, you couldn't take a camera to it, nor could you see it except in occasional blinks, you know. But, oh my goodness. Well, it was fantastic.
You came back to the UK, and it looks like you had a life of administration.
Yes.
Back in the UK.
I suppose I got back in 62, and by this time I'd made my peace with Bradford Education Authority, I suppose. I rang my old chief clerk and said, Mr. Coxon, I'm looking for a job, can you help me? He said, you give me a day to think about it, Alan. And I think that was deliberately to make me suffer because I didn't go back when I should have done at 18. And he did come back to me. He said, look, we've got a vacancy at the Bradford Technical College. If you go up and see Mr. Coulthard, the registrar, he'll tell you about it and he'll interview you. And if it's okay with him, you can have the job. So I did go, had an interview, and was set on. Now, from then, I think ambition set in. I thought, well, yeah, I can do this job. I've looked at other jobs that are going on in this office, and I think I can do some of them as well. Eventually, a vacancy came up at Keighley Technical College in the West Riding, and I applied for that and got it. And then I spent a couple of years there, and then there was an advertisement for a chief administrative officer at the Cooperative College near Loughborough. I applied for that, went for an interview, left it with them and came home. I let 2 weeks go by and said to Sue, oh, you know, we haven't heard anything, they don't want us. I said, but I'll just ring to find out if there is any news. So I rang the Education Secretary, Mr. Fox, and he said, we're waiting to hear from you. I said, I beg your pardon. He said, we've sent you a letter confirming your report, offering you the job. I said, well, sorry, I haven't got it. And then it struck me, I said, look, did you take notice in the application that I wrote to you that I would be on holiday in Tenby in South Wales from one date to another? And now I'm back home. Hang on a minute, he said. Oh, yes, he says, we've sent the offer to Tenby. When can you start? So that same day the house was up for sale and the resignation was in. From Cooperative College, I felt as though my career still lay in local authority further education. So I applied for and got a job at Grimsby. I held that for a couple of years. And then applied for the job of registrar at Doncaster College, which I got.
All this is like chalk and cheese of being in the Antarctic, isn't it? It's a completely different lifestyle.
Absolutely, yeah.
So how do those 3 years, in your case, how do those 3 years in the Antarctic rate in your lifetime as a whole?
Never to be forgotten, absolutely. In fact, I've got to admit a certain gratitude that you came here this afternoon because you've dredged quite a lot of it up that I hadn't remembered. And I don't want to forget. That was an experience of a lifetime, Chris, I can tell you. But I think what happened towards the end was that as I was growing up, there came a realisation that at some point I would have to settle down. And on returning to the UK, it wasn't long, it was only a week or two before I met Sue. Now, at the time, she was coming up to her 17th birthday. And I thought, you know, this is it. It's time to settle down. And we did. So career took over. And there have been moments, not lately, I must admit, when I've wondered about going back. But it's never happened. Nor would I now, of course, far too old for that. But those are 3 years that I wouldn't like to forget, ever. Ever, ever, ever. The friends that I had, the people that I met. The sadness is that I suppose one after another we're all popping off now, unfortunately. And if it were the case of a reunion where I knew for certain that some of the lads that I lived with for 3 years were going to be there, then I might be attracted by the idea. But to mix with people that I don't know is just not my cup of tea. Not at all.
Let's leave it there. Alan, thank you very much indeed.
Fine. Any good?
Very good.
No? Okay.